Well, we're back in 1 Samuel chapter 19 on page 262 and continuing to look at the life of David. And we're still at a relatively early stage in David's life, aren't we? Long before he gets properly appointed and starts to reign as king. And here he is in what is beginning to become, what we know is going to become a very difficult stage in David's life. And we get this glimpse now at the beginning of it, when things start to turn from something that was very positive back in chapters 15 through to much of chapter 18, and now they start to take a turn for the worse. And it's a wonderful opportunity for us to see how a man of God responds to that situation, because all of us will face these kind of things, won't we? All of us will face situations where for a time things were going very well, and for a time things were fairly positive, and in all of our lives there will become moments when things take a turn for the worse. So how do you respond when that happens? How do you deal with disappointment? How do you deal, in David's case, with outright attack? How do you deal with it when everything seems to be going against you? Well, chapter 19 gives us an opportunity to look to see how David dealt with those issues. And that can be a really help to us as we face similar situations. But there's something else in 1 Samuel 19 as well. Something that's perhaps even more important than looking at how David dealt with that trouble and difficulty. Because one of the most remarkable things about not only 1 Samuel chapter 19, but the chapters that follow, is to look at how God was with David. And how God protected David. Do you remember back in chapter 16, David was anointed as king, and he was told by God that he was going to serve in this way, but there already was a king. And David will tell us frequently in the future that it's not for him, despite his anointing, it's not for him to get rid of Saul by killing Saul, for example. I'm sure in any other nation, perhaps that's what would have happened. The young upstart would have perhaps murdered the king. That certainly happened many times, didn't it? But David was never going to do that. He was a righteous man, remember. He wasn't going to speed things up. He was going to be patient. There's a lesson there for us, isn't there? So often, many of us, we have a feel of what God's will might be for us or for our families or whatever it was. But many times, we're not prepared to wait for God's timing. Many times, we take things into our own hands. Many times, we go on the offensive, as it were, rather than waiting for the Lord's timing. David doesn't make that mistake. But as a consequence of that, he becomes the hunted. But in all of this, you see, God protects David. God keeps David. And what we'll see as we go through chapter 19 is four different ways that God protects and keeps David. Some of them very remarkable, some of them in some ways very ordinary ways. And in similar ways, God keeps and protects his people today. So really, as well as this theme of looking at how we deal with things taking a turn for the worse, as David does, as we go through this chapter, we're also going to get a glimpse into the way in which God cares for his people. And that's one of the most important things, really, for us to remember, isn't it? When things do take a turn for the worse, and when things do get difficult, to remember that God is with us, and remember that his hand is upon us. If you were here on Wednesday in the prayer meeting, we looked at this, didn't we? And the way in which God walks with us in the trial, in the fire. And we'll see just the same thing here. Perhaps the hand of God is not quite so apparent here in 1 Samuel 19 as it was in Daniel 3 on Wednesday night. But nonetheless, we'll clearly see the handiwork of God in protecting David as we go through this story. So what we'll do as we look at this chapter is we'll break the chapter into four episodes, as it were. Because there's four separate occasions in this chapter when David has an escape, as it were, from Saul. And each of those is very different. So the first one then is verses 1 through to 7, where David is saved, really, by Saul's son. By Jonathan, of course. You remember back in the previous chapter, Jonathan loved Saul. They had, as if they were brothers. And Jonathan, who was in line for the throne, remember, from Saul, he gave to Jonathan his cloak and his sword and so on, almost his seal of office. And he knew, really, somehow, maybe Jonathan had spoken about, David had spoken about, maybe he just sensed it in his own soul, but he knew, really, that David was going to be the one who was going to take God's people forward and not him. And he willingly and lovingly handed that on to David, as it were. But now, as Saul, his father, starts to have David in his sights, Jonathan now is in an almost impossible situation, isn't he? We can see that in verse 1 of chapter 19 on page 262. Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. And clearly Saul has got no idea here that Jonathan is on David's side and he's not on Saul's side. You can understand why Saul expected him to be on his side, but he doesn't know Jonathan. And you see, God already has started to work things, hasn't he? So that chapter 18 came before chapter 19, and Jonathan was already on David's side. What would have happened if maybe Jonathan's brotherly love for David had come later in the story? Maybe it would never have come at all. But God in his timing had everything just right. So at just the right time, in other words, Jonathan hears that Saul has got it in for David and he's planning to attack him. So Jonathan very wisely in verse 2 tells David this, and he explains to him, be on your guard until morning, stay in a secret place and hide. And you get the sense here, don't you, that David is going to hide somewhere, maybe in the palace or in the gardens or something like that. Because in verse 3 we're told that I will go and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. So you almost get the impression that David maybe is going to be trying to listen in to the conversation that Jonathan is going to have with Saul. And it will reassure David, no doubt, that Jonathan has his best interests at heart, but also give him an insight into what Saul really thinks. And Jonathan then speaks up for Saul, for David, doesn't he, in verses 4 and 5. And notice the line that Jonathan takes. What he tries to do is he tries to persuade Saul that what you're doing will be something that will be morally wrong. He goes, doesn't he, for this, says it would be a sin to do that. Let not the king sin against his servant. You should do what's right, in other words. Now, it's very interesting that Jonathan takes this approach, because we'll go a few more chapters into 1 Samuel, and this approach would not work later on. But here at this point, Saul is kind of teetering on the edge. He's clearly someone who's disobeyed God. He's already been rejected by God. He knows that. He's been told that by Samuel, remember, back in chapter 15. But at this point, there's still some vestige of righteousness in Saul. His conscience can still be appealed to. And it's important that we see that in this story, because that's what David does. He appeals to Saul's conscience. You need to do what's right, Saul, he says. And Saul responds well to that, doesn't he? Verse 6. He heeds the voice of Jonathan, that Saul's conscience still is speaking to him, as it were. And he still feels the impact of what Jonathan has said. And I think it's appropriate just to pause for a moment and to consider what happened to Saul here. Because maybe some of us have been in the situation that Saul has been in. Maybe some of us have been in the situation where we're starting to move away from where God would have us be. And we've begun to turn our backs on God and to go against God. That's what had happened to Saul here. He was starting to do that. And we start maybe to plan things that are wrong. Maybe you've got friends in that position. The New Testament teaches us that if that's the case, if we've got those who are starting to turn their backs on the things of God, then we do have a responsibility, as Jonathan did here, to go to them and to, as it were, plead with their consciences, that they would do what's right and they would turn from their wickedness, they would repent of it. That's what Jonathan did here to Saul. And you do sense very much, and we'll see this as the chapter goes on, that if Jonathan had waited too long, then this probably would never have worked. There was a moment at which Saul was responsive and open to such pleadings. And that moment will soon pass. And maybe if we've got friends or family who are in similar situation, who are moving away from God, maybe now is the moment at which we could speak with them and urge them and plead with their consciences that they would return and come back. Or maybe we ourselves are in that situation, and despite being present here this evening, our hearts actually are turned against God, or are beginning to turn against God. And maybe for you this evening, then this message and this story is, as it were, a wake-up call. And maybe rather than being a David or a Jonathan, you're a Saul here this evening. And it's your opportunity to turn back from moving away from the Lord. And maybe, as it were, as these words from the story plead with your conscience, to return to the Lord Jesus Christ, to give him your best, your very best. Well, that's what Jonathan did. He pleaded with Saul, and Saul, as we've said, heeds that voice in verse 6. And Saul does tend to be rather dramatic and slightly overreact. And you see that a little bit in verse 6, doesn't he? We'll see that more and more of Saul as it goes on. He kind of goes from one extreme to the other. And instead of saying simply, maybe as perhaps would have been appropriate, Jonathan, look, you're right. I'm sorry, I've been an idiot. I've been wrong. I've sinned in this way. Forgive me. Instead of saying that, he says, as the Lord lives, he shall not be killed. Well, really, he should never have said that, to give that oath in the Lord's name. That was unwise and shows really Saul, despite doing the right thing, still manages to do the right thing in the wrong way, which I'm afraid is very typical of Saul at this time. So Jonathan then, verse 7, calls David, tells him what happened, and Jonathan now brings David back to Saul, and everything is okay again, at least for a time, as we'll see. So what has God done in this story, up in this episode of the story? Well, as we said right at the beginning, he's protected David, hasn't he? And he's protected David in some ways using the most unlikely candidate, a little bit as we saw last week. The Jonathan. Jonathan's got everything to gain from David being killed. David is the one who is going to take Jonathan's throne, essentially. And Jonathan's got everything to lose. Everything to gain, rather, from David being done away with. And yet he is the one whom God has chosen to protect David. Isn't it wonderful how God works out his purposes? Very often choosing the most unlikely characters to help us on our way, in our journey, to protect us and to keep us. And that's exactly what he does here. And as we think about this, we think at the way in which God used David to do this. What David did here is he spoke to Saul, and they spoke man to man, didn't they, there out in the meadow, in the field. And Jonathan reasoned with Saul. And he gave him arguments, and it was very rational, wasn't it? And he pleaded with his conscience, as we've said. And it's through that simple human intervention, very simple in many ways, that God was able to protect David. I wonder how many times the Lord does that for us. It may be ways that we don't even know. Maybe there have been situations where somebody perhaps was very hurt over something perhaps that we'd done, and maybe they were going to retaliate against us. But a friend of that person, maybe a Christian friend, or maybe a very unlikely friend, found out about what was going to happen, found out that they were going to say things or do things that would have been incredibly hurtful to the relationship. And they've intervened. And they've reasoned with the person and spoke to them and suggested maybe more wise course of actions. I'm sure that's happened in all of our lives, hasn't it? As the Lord has raised up friends for those that we love and interact with. And those friends maybe have protected us with the Lord's help in ways that maybe we don't know and have never fully appreciated. What a wonderful thing that is when the Lord gives friends like that. And maybe for some of us, we can be that friend. What if you were to hear that there was somebody and they were going to take a particular action against somebody else? What advice would you give to them? Would you show a huge amount of sympathy and essentially egg the person on? Here's this situation, and here's this person. You'll never know, you'll never guess what so-and-so's done to me. He did this, and he did that, and he did the other. How do you respond to somebody who says those things? Well, perhaps on the one hand, it's easy. Oh, what a terrible thing. How dare they do that? You know what you should do? You should get them back. Get them before they get you again. They deserve to be punished for what they've done. Do this, do that, do the other. It's easy maybe to say that. But perhaps it would be wiser sometimes to urge somebody to do the right thing. Not to lose their temper. Not to take things into their own hands. But to deal wisely and calmly with the situation, as Jonathan did here. And maybe God could use you to protect somebody else from that sort of hurt. Well, That was the first episode as David was saved, essentially, by Jonathan, by Saul's son. And now we come to the second episode in verses 8 through to 10, because there we find that there's no human being involved at all. Because what happens here is that David goes with Saul and everything's kind of back to normal, end of verse 7, just as it was before. Everything's fine, everything's very good. But then verse 8, war comes again. And David, as no doubt commanded by Saul, goes off into battle and finds success on the battlefield once more. And the people, you can imagine, will be singing David's praises once again, just as they were in chapter 17. And now, of course, the jealousy arises in Saul's mind again, just as it had before. So this time, as David is in Saul's presence, we read in verse 10 that Saul sought to pin David to the wall with his spear. But he slipped away from Saul's presence, and Saul drove the spear into the wall. So David's been rescued again, wasn't he? There he was. He was about to be killed. The spear was thrown, and Saul threw the spear. And by the time the spear reached the point where David was, David is there no longer. He slipped away. He's gone. And the spear is just quivering, embedded in the wall. You can see it in your mind's eye, can't you? God rescued David. Now, this is a very different rescue, isn't it, to what's gone before? Before, it was all rational and calm, and Jonathan was involved, this friend of David who intervened on his behalf with God's help. But now all of that is gone. What rescued David this time? Was it luck? That's what some people would say. Well, of course it wasn't. It was providence. We're not told that David saw what Saul was doing. Maybe he just finished his piece and got up and went his way. Maybe somebody called him. Maybe he needed the loo. It could be all kinds of reasons. But up he goes, and then that's that moment that the spear comes and embeds itself in the wall. And David is rescued and saved. It's a remarkable rescue in many ways. But to anybody looking on, perhaps, it wouldn't seem all that remarkable. It was just good fortune. It was just good luck. And yet the Lord in his goodness moved the hand of Saul, caused David to rise at just the right time. But notice something interesting. We mustn't miss this, must we, in verse 9. Now the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. So who do we blame for this spear going into David's wall? Well, we do get these little phrases in the story of Saul about distressing spirits that come from the Lord. What do we make of them? Because very often they seem to cause Saul to do things that are wrong and evil. In this case, he had a murderous intent, didn't he? Saul seemed to have murderous intent. Is that what the Lord caused and raised up in Saul? What happened here? Well, we need to understand what's going on in these chapters, don't we? And we'll come to this again by the time we get to the end of the chapter. But we need to remember back in chapter 15, we never studied it, but we have referred to it often because it's in chapter 15 that God says to Saul, no longer will you be king over Israel. And really what was required from Saul at that point was to abdicate, was to hand on his kingly rule and authority to David. There could have been a smooth transfer of power. The people obviously were all on David's side. He was a very popular figure. If Saul had stood down and handed over to David, peace would have reigned in the nation. Saul perhaps would have appeared to all the people to be somebody who was generous and who remarkably sacrificed himself for the good of the nation so that David, the mighty warrior, could take over as king. That's what would have happened, wouldn't it, if Paul had handed on the reins of power, having been told by Samuel that God had rejected him because of his sin. That's what Saul should have done. But of course, Saul didn't do that. He did what many people do. He clung to power, didn't he? And really, the whole of 1 Samuel is exactly this. Saul clinging to power. Desperately clinging to power. We've seen something of that in Ukraine, I think, haven't we, over the last week? And it's a story that's often repeated. Men clinging to power. We need to be very careful, of course, that we don't fall into that trap ourselves, do we? We may not be rejected by the Lord, but sometimes the Lord does make it clear to us that maybe it's time to move on. Maybe it's time to give something up. Maybe it's time to do something new. And too often, maybe, we ourselves tend to cling to what we know and the responsibilities and maybe the privileges that we have, rather than pass them on to those who maybe the Lord is raising up to take over from us. But that's, by the way, as it were, the point is, that Saul is the one who's been rejected by God and who refuses to stand down. So what does the Lord do? Well, clearly the Lord's hand is against Saul. We need to know that. It's clear in these chapters, the Lord's hand is against him. Because when the Lord withdraws from somebody, and when the Lord says that essentially you're to stand down, I've rejected you as king, then he will carry that out. And that's really what he's doing here, that he's working against Saul. We've seen that already, haven't we, in chapter 18. Well, what did he find in chapter 18? Well, we found in chapter 18 that everybody loved David and more than they loved Saul. Wasn't that a message that David should have understood? Well, all of the people seem to love David more than they love me. Should he be surprised at that? His own son loves David. Should he be surprised at that? His own daughter loves David and wants to marry him. Should he be surprised at that? Because now in chapter 19, those people are now working against Saul and working for David. Do you see? That this message slowly should have been coming home to Saul, but he's getting increasingly desperate. God's hand is against him. And this distressing spirit that comes on Saul is precisely because God's hand is against him. Because if God's hand is against you, you need to know, don't you? You need to know if God's hand is against you. And this is one of the means, this distressing spirit, this is one of the means that God uses to let Saul know. He doesn't want Saul to be happy being a king when he shouldn't be king. He doesn't want that. So he sends this distressing spirit. Now, of course, there are consequences to that, aren't there? And these consequences here could have been disastrous, but of course God intervened and God kept David, as we've said. But even as we notice there in verse 19, this distressing spirit that came from the Lord came upon Saul. Look at what Saul was doing. He was sitting in his house with a spear in his hand. What sort of man sits in his house with a spear in his hand? We don't have spears nowadays, do we? I guess the equivalent would be a man sitting in his house with a gun in his hand. What sort of man would do that? Remember, Saul is a man who is surrounded by soldiers, better protected than almost any other man on the planet in these days. And yet here is a man who sits with a spear in his hand, in his own house. He's clearly a man who's desperately afraid, isn't he? Fearful. And of course he's fearful, because we'll find out by the time we get to the end of 1 Samuel, he's absolutely, utterly alone. That's Saul's problem. He's surrounded by people all of the time. He's got these guards and soldiers who he's commanding to do this and to do that. He's got even David with him. But his heart is against David, so David's presence is not a comfort. He's got his son Jonathan with him, but Jonathan loves David and his presence is not a comfort. His daughter has married David, and really he's got no one at all. That's the thing you notice. He's desperately alone, and he's fearful. He's frightened. And that's why he's got his spear in his hand. And sometimes when frightened men have their backs against the wall, they lash out, which is what Saul did here. You see, if the Lord's hand is against you, he will work things in such a way so that you know that the Lord's hand is against you. Why? So that you can act appropriately and rightly in those circumstances. You can do the right thing. Saul, sadly, tragically, did the wrong thing and lashed out at David, the very one who could have been of aid and help to him. But God, in his providence, saves Saul this time, not through the reasoned argument of a man, but this time through the quirk and the providence of David, just getting up at just the right moment and slipping away. We're into the third episode now in verses 11 through to 17, because now, whereas a moment ago David was saved by Saul's son, now we're going to find he's saved by Saul's daughter. That's exactly what happens, isn't it? Verse 11 through to 17. It's the turn of Michal now. And whereas at the beginning of the chapter it was Jonathan who discovered that of Saul's plot, now it's Michal, David's wife and Saul's daughter, because Saul sends messengers, spies essentially, to watch David's house. And maybe he doesn't want to make an attack in the dark. You can understand that, can't you? So he's going to wait till the morning. And then there's going to be, a kind of SAS raid on David's property with Saul's messengers. And Saul wants to make sure that David doesn't slip away in the night. So he mounts guards around the property overnight. But Michal, who has a tendency to spot things, she spots these guards hiding in the bushes. And she tells David, look at these men. Saul's messengers are out to get you. You need to slip away. So they hatch this plot, as it were. She lets David down through a window. Maybe the house is on the edge of the town, or we're not sure. Maybe on some kind of wall. Maybe he goes down through this window and he flees, and he's now on the run. Verse 13, she takes now an image, still not shaken off the idolatry of previous generations. She takes this image, she puts it in the bed, she covers it, and it looks, at least in the dark, in the dusk from a distance, it looks as though David is sleeping in the bed. And in the morning then, Saul's messengers come to take David. They're not going to kill him where he is. They're going to take him back, and they're going to have some message for him. The king wants to see you, and they're going to escort him back to the palace, and there the deed will be done. But Michal, of course, is the king's daughter. And the lowly soldiers, even the ones sent to arrest David, as it were, are not going to mess with the king's daughter. So the king's daughter comes to the door and says, well, you can't come in and see David. He's sick. I'm not letting you into my house. And her royal privilege means that they can't argue with her, orders or no orders. So they troop back to Saul with their tails a little bit between their legs. And, of course, David now is given time to escape. And Saul then sends the messengers back. Don't take no for an answer, he says, verse 15. And then verse 16, therefore, they come into the bedroom and they see what's happened. And Saul then is summoned, and he says to Michal, what are you doing? And she, I think, probably unwisely, I think that's the conclusion we're supposed to draw. She doesn't do what Jonathan did earlier on. Michal, for all her protection of David, actually goes about things in not quite the helpful way that Jonathan does. Jonathan's much more honest and upfront, isn't he? Much more rational and pleading to Saul's conscience, rather. Well, Michal is a bit more underhand. And she now lies again to Saul. He said to me, let me go, why should I kill you? Which, of course, is not what happened at all, and probably actually doesn't do David any favours in the long term. You kind of wish that Michal maybe had done what Jonathan had did and said, well, why are you trying to kill him? He's doing you a favour, he's being nice to you. And maybe, perhaps, Saul might have been restrained once more. But that's not what she does. So let's look at how God protects David in this situation, because it's quite different, isn't it, to what happened at the beginning? Because what happened at the beginning was Jonathan rather acting in a righteous way and pleading with Saul's conscience and doing things in this very right and proper way. And here we have Michal in quite a flawed way in some ways, using deception and all kinds of things that maybe we shouldn't copy or practice. Protecting David. You see, this is one of the remarkable things about God's providence, isn't it? That God's providence for us doesn't just work through the good and the righteous. But God's providence for you and for me works for the wicked and the failed and the failing. It's an incredible situation to find that that's exactly what God does. But he does do it, doesn't he? You look at the way in which God has acted through history. How he got the children of Israel back into Egypt, into Israel after they'd been captive in Babylon. How did he do it? He did it through a pagan king, through Cyrus. Nobody expected that. But that's what he does. How did he end up in a situation where Moses was able to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt? How were they to be rescued there? All kinds of incredible things happened in the story in the providence of Moses, didn't he? That he was the one who was raised up in the palace that gave him access to the Pharaoh later on, just as he needed. But how did that come about? Well, because another Pharaoh had killed all the baby boys. And through that providence and many other providences that followed, Moses was in a position to have all that he needed to be able to carry out God's will and God's purposes later on. And your life and my life, you see, is shaped not just by the good and the righteous, but it's shaped by sins that have been committed against us and even by sins that we've committed ourselves. And there are things that we've done through mixed motives, probably more of that than the things done through pure motives, aren't there? Things that we've maybe done the right thing in the wrong way. And God uses all of that to bring about his purposes and to make sure that his sovereign plan continues. God is able to do these incredible things and work them incredible ways. And I hope that gives you some encouragement, you know. Because very often we are Michals, aren't we? And we do the wrong thing. Maybe for the right reasons, but we do them in the wrong way. And we need to take encouragement that God can use even our feeble acts And even the things that we do that are wrong, and God, it wasn't that God's purposes were suddenly thwarted because Michal didn't do quite as righteously as Jonathan did she? It's not thwarted then. God still works out his purposes. And there are sometimes, you know, when we're so arrogant and foolish that we think our little sins have somehow thwarted God's eternal plan. What a silly thing to think. Have you ever thought that? I certainly have. I think most of us probably have. Everything was going fine until I did X. And now everything's going to be a disaster. Well, if you think you doing X is really going to turn God away from his eternal purposes, then I think you've got your perspective wrong. I'm not saying that sin doesn't matter. Of course sin matters. We need to repent of it wherever we see it in ourselves. But when we've let God down, or where we do things through wrong motives, or where we do the right thing in the wrong way, as Michal did here, know that God can still work out his purposes. And God uses flawed people to do his purposes and to carry out his will, as well as righteous people. So we now have the final episode in verses 18 through to 24, and this is the strangest of all. So David has fled and escaped. He's been bought time by Michal, and he goes to Samuel at Ramah. Remember, Samuel is the one who anointed him. Samuel is the one who knows. Samuel is the one, he's got great influence, or at least he did have, in the nation. You understand why that's where David went. And he tells verse 18, Samuel, all that Saul had done to him. You can imagine how Samuel would have been dismayed to hear it all. And he stays there with Samuel in Nioth, in Ramah. And of course, Saul very quickly, you can't hide much from a king, can you? Saul very quickly finds out that that's where David is. So he sends these messengers to arrest David once again. So what's God going to do this time? Well, he does something incredibly strange, something almost unique. Because, remember, Samuel is a prophet. And he's not a prophet who works on his own, but he's got a little group of other prophets. We sometimes call them the school of the prophets, who are with Samuel, and they're also prophesying. And there they are, and they have a little camp together. They live in this little village or settlement called Nioth. And the soldiers come to this group of prophets, and David, no doubt, is in the midst of the prophets somewhere. And the prophets are prophesying, as prophets do. And then the Spirit of God comes upon the messengers of Saul, verse 20, and they also prophesied. What an astonishing thing. So here are these messengers of Saul who are essentially coming to do a wicked deed to take away David and arrest him so that he can be murdered. How does God deal with him, with them? You'd expect maybe lightning bolts from heaven. A lion jumping out from behind a tree, destroying them. But it's not what God does, is it? He sends his Spirit on them that they also prophesied. What a remarkable thing. It gets even more remarkable because Saul hears what's happening. It's almost as if the messengers of Saul, can you see what God is doing here? It's important we understand this. It's almost as if the messengers of Saul are going over and they're no longer messengers of Saul. They're now prophets, or in other words, they're messengers of God. You see what's happening? Because this has been happening right throughout chapter 18 and 19. Jonathan was Saul's son, but he becomes David's friend. Michal was Saul's daughter, but she becomes David's wife. And now the messengers of Saul, who were on his side, as it were, their allegiance, not through their choice, it has to be said, their allegiance is being switched, and they now become God's messengers. Do you see? So God is clearly telling Saul something through this. He's saying, look, you can throw all that you like at me. You can have all these people, but I'm going to keep taking these people away from you. And it's leaving Saul essentially exposed and naked with nobody left to protect him. And we'll see by the end that Saul's a bit slow to get that message and God really has to drum that home. But that's where all this is heading. God is taking people away. The people that Saul would have had as protecting him, he's taking them all away. And he's saying, look, they're on my side now. Let's carry on. Verse 21, when Saul was told, he sent other messengers and they prophesied likewise. He's a bit slow, you see. He keeps sending more people. He's not getting the message. He hears what's happening, but he's not computing it. He's not understanding it. He's not listening. He's blind to what God is doing. He sends a third time. They prophesied also. Haven't you got the message, Saul? They're not your messengers anymore. They're my messengers. They're doing my will, God is saying. Do you see? Verse 22. So what does Saul do? Well, any sensible, reasonable, rational person would say, do you know what? I'm not going to win this battle. And maybe even if you wanted to make to not admit defeat, at least regroup and try another day. But not Saul. You see, he has been opposed and his heart has been against God for too long now, and rationality has gone out of the window. He's got one thing in mind, kill David. And it doesn't matter how he does it. It doesn't matter when it happens, but it's going to happen. He's going to make sure it happens, and he's going to do it himself. Do you see? Verse 22, he also went to Ramah. You can almost hear him. Can you see these idiots? What are they doing? If you want something done properly, you've got to do it yourself. That's his attitude as he goes off to Ramah. He comes to the great well that's at Seku. Where are Samuel and David? And they're told they're at Naioth. So off he goes. And look what happens, verse 23. No lightning from the sky, no lion from behind a tree, no rockfall that comes from a mountain to cover him. No, but it's the Spirit of God was upon him also. And he too, just as the messengers had done before him, prophesied even earlier than them. He prophesies just when he's left the well. And he prophesies all the way to Naioth. Can you see verse 23 at the end? In Ramah. But he does something else. The Spirit of God takes Saul and does something with Saul that didn't happen with the others. Do you remember what I was saying before? That what God was doing was taking everything that Saul had that may have protected him and kept him, the things that Saul, or the people particularly that Saul was trusted him, and saying, Jonathan, you thought he was yours, that he would protect you? No, he's mine. He's on David's side. Michal, your daughter, you thought she was yours, she would protect you? No, she's on my side, on David's side. Your messengers, that first group, you thought they protect you? No, they're my messengers. They're prophesying now. The second group, they're my messengers now. The third group, they're my messengers now. And here is Saul now marching up to Naioth, utterly alone. And everything's been stripped away. And to make sure that Saul really gets the message, verse 24, the Spirit of God comes upon Saul in such a way that it causes Saul to strip off his clothes, and he prophesies before Samuel in like manner, lay down naked all that day and all that night. Now, naked here may mean in undergarments as opposed to completely naked, but nevertheless the point remains, doesn't it? What a humiliating position for a king to be in. And he's prophesying before Samuel, do you see? Before the anointed prophet of God. So here is Samuel in his little camp with his other prophets around him, and there is Saul prostrate before him, prophesying, helpless, unable to say what he wants to say. He's no doubt, as he was coming up to the journey, rehearsing all the things that he was going to say and do. How dare Samuel, you give shelter to this one who is against me. You can imagine all of this, but he can't say any of that. All he can say is what God wants him to say, because he's prophesying. So what's Saul due to take from this? Well, surely now he must take the idea, I've been stripped of everything. Isn't that what God had promised back in chapter 15? You're no longer the king. I've turned my back on you. I'm stripping all that away. And now his royal robes have gone too. Jonathan gave his voluntary to David. Saul tore his off in this fit of mad prophecy. And he is naked and helpless. Surely now, Saul, you get the message. But of course, sadly, tragically in the story, that Saul didn't get the message. That despite all the ways in which God told this to Saul, he didn't listen. And he just kept on opposing God, opposing God, opposing God. We see something of the incredible patience of God, I think, with Saul, don't we? God could have smote him and struck him down. But through all these ways, he didn't. And Saul needs to know one other thing as well from this story. He knows the Spirit of God has come upon his messengers, even though they're doing an unholy work. And now the Spirit of God comes upon him who's doing an unholy work. And that should help him to realize that just because he's got this position of kingship, and technically he's the Lord's anointed, as it were, doesn't mean to say that he's a righteous man, and doesn't mean to say that he's doing the Lord's will. And that's a lesson I think for each one of us. That sometimes we feel maybe that we're in such and such a position. We're doing such and such a things, the Lord must be with me. But that wasn't the case for Saul, was it? We need to look at hearts, we need to look at motives, we need to look at relationship with God. That's much more important than the role that we hold or the office that we have. And Saul's heart was opposed to God, and yet here he was prophesying under the influence of the Spirit of God. It's a sobering story from Saul's point of view, as God has now stripped him entirely of everything, and yet still Saul hasn't got the message. And maybe God has done that to you, metaphorically as it were, obviously. He stripped you of everything, every protection that you'd built up for yourself. And you know, as it were, that you stand, as it were, naked before him. You've got no protection, nothing left. It's just you and him. And you're prostrate, as it were, before him, helpless. You can't fight back. But I wonder now, finally, will you bow the knee to him? Will you acknowledge that his way is best, that he really is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords? Because if you oppose God as Saul did, you will find that there's no escape and no chance of victory. And yet, on the other hand, if you're a David this evening, if you're someone who belongs to the Lord, then know that in all kinds of ways, some very ordinary ways, a son having a discussion with his father, some extraordinary ways, the Spirit of God coming upon a man, God will protect you and God will see you home. And we need to remember, don't we, each one of us, that there is one who opposes us. We don't often see all that opposition. God is protecting us in ways that we never know. But he will keep us, just as he kept David. It won't always be easy. It wasn't always easy for David. But he will see us home.